I read something this morning about a comet in the 1930s. It was in Finland.
It affected the people. After it passed, they would get lost. They would end up in the wrong home. They would forget things. They wouldn't really know where they were. And I remember reading about this one woman who called the police and said, "The man in my house is not my husband." And then the police came over and they said, "This is your husband." She said, "No, this is not my husband. I killed my husband yesterday.
Awesome.
That's how I know it's not him."
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus movie review of Coherence.
Kind of strange, very mysterious.
A Podbean backer review chosen by Albert Kovacs from Las Vegas.
My brother, he says, if anything strange were to happen while the comet was passing over, that we should stay inside and that I should do my best to contact him.
Hosted by Stuart, Jacob, and Arnie.
We don't even belong here.
You are fucking too much, man. You are fucking too much.
Listen, we're visitors here. This isn't our house.
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
You know what? Put a quarter into the swear jar.
Listener discretion is advised.
Then here's to the life that we do lead.
Yeah. Well said.
Here's to the comet.
The comet.
Today we're discussing Coherence, starring Emily Baldoni, Maury Sterling, Nicholas Brendan, directed by James Ward Burkitt. This is the barely coherent co-host of Now Playing, Arnie.
This is Stuart.
And this is Jacob. The Jacob.
I gotta see your glow stick.
This is getting weird, guys.
Not as weird as this movie we're discussing. And why are we discussing Coherence? Because of Albert Kovacs from Las Vegas. He is one of our Podbean patrons who bumped up for 1 month to the big pledge so that he could pick a movie for us to review. And the movie he picked was Coherence. His rationale was he didn't see any other way that we would ever get to this. It doesn't really fit as part of a retrospective series. I don't know if we ever did like a Donnie Darko, this could be an Easter egg to it or something like that. But he really wanted to hear us work through this movie, so thank you, Albert, for your support.
Yes, I don't know that we would have ever gotten to this movie, but I at least pride myself on knowing about it. I had seen it. It had streamed on some kind of online system that I had clicked a button a couple of years ago and did check it out and thought it was pretty cool.
I was going to say, if it wasn't for Albert, not only was there probably not a chance we wouldn't do this movie, this is the first time I've ever even heard of this one.
I had heard the name because I go to a lot of places Nicholas Brendan frequents, and I'm not talking bars or, well, that sounds bad because he has an alcohol problem, but I don't mean restaurants. I'm talking comic conventions, and they're always promoting that actor's latest work. But I wouldn't have been able to pull that out of my own memory until I looked it up. I'm like, oh yeah, that Nicholas Brendan thing. I've seen that poster before. But that's pretty much how I thought of this until I actually watched it, is that Nicholas Brendan thing.
You know, I'm a sucker for science fiction, and by that I don't mean necessarily science fantasy. I think a lot of times when you hear the word sci-fi, you're thinking of big budget stuff and, you know, art direction, spectacle, space battles, all of that. I'm cool with that too. Believe me, I like me some Blade Runner, but I really do think that there's a whole genre or subgenre that allows the ideas of science to be explored on a very minimal budget. And really, going back really even to the 50s, I mean, those were low-budget movies. In the 80s, Terminator and what have you were considered low-budget movies. But I do think with the advent and the acceptance of video cameras, we've seen a whole lot of this kind of movie in the last 17 years. Pi is probably the first one to really hit it big.
Pi, which is in the book, a favorite of mine by Darren Aronofsky. Yeah, I've noticed, you're calling it micro-budget. Just these small indie films where, like, the sci-fi might even just be in the background. I mean, I'm thinking of, like, Safety Not Guaranteed or The One I Love, where they're very small. They're almost not sci-fi, but they're just barely sci-fi enough.
Yeah, I've definitely noticed that kind of moving forward in both sci-fi and, to a lesser degree, just supernatural stories, sometimes ghost stories. Hell, Paranormal Activity is the epitome of this, right? I mean, it's admittedly it's found footage, which is a slightly different beast, but still very low budget. implications of supernatural goings on.
Usually in a confined space. I think that the micro budget, the difference between a low budget like Terminator and a micro budget is like, okay, we only got like three actors and they're going to be in this room the whole time. Primer, Cube, Another Earth, which is surprisingly similar to this movie, in fact.
Mangler 3.
No, doesn't count. No. Not counting that one. Moon might count. But yeah, I do think that it's a real challenge. Can you be engaging on an intellectual level if all you've got are characters confined in a space that have to talk their way through interesting conundrum?
Well, another interesting coincidence that we're discussing this movie now is the director and co-writer, James Burkitt. It turns out I saw his other work very recently as part of our Pirates of the Caribbean retrospective. This guy worked on the Pirates films, and he also made that short film that I briefly talked about, Wedlocked, that was the tale of the wenches before Johnny Depp. And one of those wenches that got to slap Johnny Depp is even in this film. So I got to see his directorial debut, really, other than the Rango video game, and then his feature debut here.
Yeah, basically, he's Gore Verbowski's good friend. They go back all the way to Mouse Hunt. And yeah, I think he comes in with design work. He's an illustrator, an animator. Rango was really kind of his baby that I think Gore helped shepherd, used his name to get to the screen. So if you have seen Rango, that would count as seeing this man's first film. But Arnie, you mentioned Paranormal Activity. That is exactly what was on Paramount Pictures' mind. That's actually how we got this film, was after they bought that little movie for a song and saw that the profits, I mean, it's probably one of the most profitable movies when you consider how much it cost to how much it made of all time. They wanted to do more of that. So they were fishing for ideas, and they knew this man's work for big-scale Pirates of the Caribbean action set pieces. He had also made a little sci-fi short about people that had located where God lived, Fractilus, and they were like, well, what else can you do? Can you work on that budget, maybe a little bit more, and can you make one for us?
Wait, he actually, this was greenlit, and he had a studio backing? This wasn't just something he did a few nights with some friends on a lark and then sold?
I looked up this cast because I didn't recognize no one here. And yeah, they all had actor in their IMDb because I think they were in this movie. But set designer, makeup artist, screenwriter, like none of them were actors. Who are all these people?
Well, Nicholas Brendon used to act.
It's a mix. There are some people that were actors, character actors, you know, people that might appear in this week's CSI, not necessarily name above the title kind of stars. But yeah, I think there were some accomplished people. And then yes, some people that filled in. But to your point, was this a studio production? It started out that way. But what James Ward Burkitt ultimately realized is, why would I risk having my film compromised? If you're not giving me any money, why am I going to take studio notes? So he ended up walking away, finding an independent producer. And yes, he made this movie very rapidly. It's funny. Rango had come out and been a success, and he was looking at other projects. His wife got pregnant, and she was due January 2012. And he realized 5 weeks ahead of time that he'd like to shoot this movie in his house. And so that was the deadline to getting it done, was that we have to beat the baby, because once there's a kid crying in the crib, we'll never be able to do pickups.
Nice tax write-off, too.
Yeah, this is definitely an interesting production, the way it was shot in Five Nights, the way they shot this with, honestly, my still camera, a Canon 5D, which I used to take toy photographs. They shot a movie with it.
It's an exciting world. I mean, cell phone movies would soon be bought from Sundance. I think we are in the era now where, yeah, if you're going to be indie, there's really no difference between the higher end equipment and what's commercially available to anyone right now. And there was no script per se. The actors signed on to this out of goodwill for this director. They trusted that he had a story worked out, but they were never given anything more than a page a day. They were kind of told what their character should be. It was kind of loosely based on who they were anyway. And they would show up each day having no idea where the story would take them next. 5 days of that. kind of like Blair Witch, you know, where you feel like the quote-unquote actors are being manipulated to give a performance as opposed to bringing their actorly techniques to a role.
Slight difference. These are a bunch of people sitting around a comfortable house drinking wine. Blair Witch, they actively withheld food to get more emotional responses.
Yeah, but it is funny. Yeah, the lead actress here, Emily Baldoni, she thought she was doing your traditional indie. She heard people sitting around a table talking to one another. She was hoping it was going to be like a Judd Apatow comedy. It starts that way, maybe, but...
A little bit, yeah.
I imagine by day two, she was on to them. Something here is not Judd Apatow at all. But I do know that the producer they got was a big fan of The Big Chill, and that was sort of a influence to these early scenes. Friends getting together, it has been a while since they've seen one another. And then the concept that they had when they started was, what if the power went out and there was one house in the entire neighborhood that had power? From there, the director-writer really hashed it out with one of the actors, the guy who plays Amir, Alex Magnugian. He is a co-creator of this storyline. They had worked on this a year before they shot this in 5 days.
And when I heard that, I read the Wikipedia and IMDb trivia. This feels like some of those projects I've quote-unquote worked on for a year. Hey, Amir, you want to grab some dinner? And like over dinner, hey, what about that idea we had? This does not feel like an idea.
See, tax write-off again.
Exactly. Let's talk about this plot idea so we can write off the meal. It doesn't feel like they sat in a writer's room every day for a year carefully constructing this. Otherwise, they'd have had a script. I don't think they wanted to be scriptless so much as when the time came, they had the story idea and 5 days to shoot in his house.
It's difficult to say with the fact that the production came together so quickly. 5 weeks from getting your producer to being done photographing and having a baby to boot. I mean, that's like student film work. Honestly, I've had film classes that lasted longer than that. So quite a lot to undertake in a short amount of time. But again, they did have a long time to ruminate on it. Amir was a voice actor on Rango, so they knew each other from that project, and that's probably where they started talking about it. But what did they come up with? Arnie, why don't you give them the plot? Then we'll go really close and see if we can see if there's any coherence.
Yes, I can give you the plot. It took me 2 watchings to fully get this plot. So here it is. One night in 2013, Miller's Comet is making its pass by Earth. And on that night, 8 friends are gathering for a dinner party. The night is hosted by former Roswell star Mike, played by former Buffy star Nicholas Brendon, and his wife Lee, who owns Skype, and played by Lorraine Severa. And thank you, Lee, we use Skype quite a bit. Attending is New Age drug proponent Beth, played by Elizabeth Grayson, and her lawyer husband Hugh, played by Hugh Armstrong. Also coming is Kevin, played by Maury Sterling, with his girlfriend, washed-up dancer M, played by Emily Baldoni. But it's upsetting to M that also coming is Kevin's ex, Lori, played by Lauren Marr, with her new boyfriend, Amir, played by co-writer Alex Manoogian. The night goes pretty well, though everyone's iPhone screen shatters due to the comet. But then they lose power. They see a house 2 blocks up that has power, and Hugh and Amir go to see if they can make a phone call. As Hugh's quantum physicist brother said, if anything weird happens, call him. Then things take strange turns. Hugh and Amir come back. Hugh has a head wound and Amir is carrying a strange box. Inside the box are photos of the house guests with numbers on the back. And Hugh seems to think up the road was a duplicate of this house, including the same house guests. Long story short, in between the two houses is a dark area. And when people step into that area, they emerge in a parallel universe. It's not long before there are people from 3 or 4 different realities all in Mike and Lorraine's house. Some of the houses used red glow sticks, some blue, and each house ended up putting a box of photos together, always the same photos, but they rolled dice so there are different numbers on the back. And each house puts a random item in the box to identify the box as from their own reality. Now everyone in this house reacts differently to this revelation. Most don't seem to react much at all, but Emily gets the idea to improve her life. She hops universe to universe until she finds one where she is a successful dancer and her relationship with Kevin is going well. She then proceeds to attack that universe's Emily, first drugging her and then concussing the girl and leaving her in a bathtub. But the next morning, Emily wakes up. The comet is gone. She's stuck in that new reality. But the other Emily is calling Kevin, probably to tell him about the attack, as credits roll.
Yeah, and if that didn't totally make sense to you, if you haven't seen this movie, I imagine it might not. I think all of us are probably going to walk away from this. This is my third time viewing it. I don't know that you're going to be able to identify the source of all the mysteries here. It is certainly a puzzle movie, and from the marketing of it going into this, I expected a brain tease. I expected something along the order of Memento.
I watched the trailer for this because we recorded this right after Memorial Day weekend. I had house guests. I kept trying to find time to watch Coherence, so I was trying to sell them on the idea of watching it with me. And they're like, I don't understand. What's this movie? So I called up iTunes. There was the trailer. I played it. A, nobody wanted to watch the movie. And B, the universal response was, I have no idea what you just showed me, what this movie's about. What is this?
Yeah, I did not know anything going into this. I just trying to talk my wife into watching it with me. So I'm like, here's the one line description from IMDb, because I literally had nothing to tell her what this movie was about. It was like, a comet goes overhead and weird things start happening. She's like, all right, maybe it turns into a weird, cool, like slasher, or who knows?
That's kind of Night of the Creeps, as a comet comes along and brings the creeps.
Or more recently, Lars von Trier did Melancholia, where the comet crashed into Earth and it really ruined a wedding. I mean, yeah, there's fun ways of intersecting a domestic situation with the cosmic. And that's what I assumed this was going to be.
Now, I didn't watch the trailer before the first time I watched this movie. I went in completely cold, knowing nothing about it other than some of the stuff that when Albert first chose the movie, I just saw on Wikipedia. I knew this was mostly improv. I knew this was cheap. I was thinking Blair Witch.
You knew it was science fiction.
I knew there was something strange about it. I knew it wasn't a comedy or drama. I didn't know science fiction versus, you know, we've been covering a lot of David Lynch, surrealism. I didn't know what exactly to expect out of it. I didn't realize it was going to be a movie that barely left the house, but I was kind of open to it when we start off with Emily. She's driving her car to this house party, talking with Kevin, who we'll later find out is her boyfriend, on the phone. I'm trying to pay attention to everything. I think this movie does a great job of introducing its characters. You know, a party scenario can get very confusing, but by having people kind of arrive onesie-twosie, I was able to keep people straight.
You were? Because I wasn't. I had to pause, go to IMDb, because they weren't saying anyone's names. I heard of Kevin. I knew M. I started writing short-haired lady, dark-haired lady.
I didn't know names, but I kept straight who was who. Yes, in my notes are platinum blonde, beard guy, brunette.
Yeah, it was hard for me to keep who stories who. I know the Lori's coming over, and that's a bad thing. I mean, it feels a little bit chaotic, because I guess it is improv. I'm not turned off by it. It's just trying to get into this and keep track of who's who, and when they're dropping, you know, they talk a lot about Emily's talking to Kevin on the phone at the beginning as she's driving to that party when that screen cracks. I don't know who Kevin is until I paused and looked up the actor so I could match it with the face.
Yeah, what the first scene really tells me is that there's going to be an intersection between the supernatural and the tension between these relationships, as it should be. Again, I like that. I like it when you're going to get weird, surreal, and what have you. If that is a way about talking about emotions and how people interact with each other in a creative way, I think that is something that an indie movie can do very well. What I guess I'm hearing from both you guys is you would have preferred a bigger budget if for no other reason than going with name actors. You would have been able to follow these actors if you had seen their face before?
No, I could have used more of a script. I'll just say that throughout this, I mean, there's 8 people at this party. That's a lot of people to ask me to pay attention and connect with in a movie. Usually it's 1 or 2. I needed more characterization here. I'm getting a lot of shorthand, like the way they're talking about Lori. I'm like, oh, she's not to be trusted. She's the one that's going to go screw everyone's boyfriend. But I don't know who I'm supposed to invest in because there are so many here and because there isn't much of a script to develop those relationships.
Yeah, I don't need name actors. The fact that Nicholas Brendon was here was actually more of a distraction for me than an asset. And he was the one I knew coming in. A couple of the others looked familiar to me, but in many cases, it turned out they looked just like somebody else from something else. And I agree with Jacob. What my problem was, especially on the first watching, is while I was able to keep straight each character's through line in the first viewing, even if I didn't get their names, every bit of information is delivered in a really haphazard way. We're full of a movie with people talking over each other, multiple conversations. It added to realism. I've hosted dinner parties and attended them. This is what happens. You have side conversations. You have multiple people talking at once, but it does not allow any character to really grab the spotlight. I kind of felt like this was going to be Mike and Lee's movie, since it's Mike and Lee's house. Even though I should have realized we're first introduced to M, so M, it's her movie, I'm trying to get a bead on just who is conveying what bit of important information at what time. I think that having them improv and giving them, hey, go in this direction, hey, say this thing, this movie did lack coherence for me. I get what they were trying to do, but I didn't get invested in any of the characters because they're just kind of fumbling through. I mean, I guess the one I notice the most is Beth, because she's the one who shows up with a ketamine mixture, horse tranquilizer, and is like offering it to people recreationally.
Scandal. Come on, we all know Elizabeth Grayson, right? She's Bill Clinton's mistress.
He had so many mistresses. Yes. How can I keep this one straight?
More mistresses than the dinner guests at this party in the film.
Oh, but she was, if you ever saw in the 90s that Highlander TV series, she had a big role on it. They gave her a whole spinoff show. She had her own following. She was as big as Xena.
If you say so.
Her I knew, Nicholas Brendon I knew, and I figured Emily was important because she is defined alone in the first scene and the one that has the problem. She has the boyfriend who is asking a commitment from her that she doesn't know if she can commit to. I get that she has the central conflict. I'm a character that can't make decisions for myself. And indeed, once she sits down and starts talking with the other guests, we see her life has become so unhappy because she let an opportunity pass her by, one that would have made her famous and theoretically happy.
I understood that M was going to be the main character. It opens up with her, and she's got the problem with Kevin on the phone, and she's going to give a monologue about her dance career. I just didn't know it was only going to be about her. And because there is no script, some of this dialogue is so clunky. When this comet's going overhead, she starts giving comet history out of nowhere. I guess it's just stuff she knows, how there was a woman who murdered her husband, and the cops showed up, and they're like, no, you didn't. Your husband's right there. Oh, that's a hint for later on. It's just clumsy exposition.
No, I disagree with clumsy. What it tells me is character. She's someone that's worried about this. Everyone else is like, oh yeah, I've heard something about that. In fact, there's another guest that starts telling that story. He's like, I read something about it today. She's like, yeah, I know very specifically. It happened in 1933. This and happened. I take it to mean that she is a worrier, that she went to Wiki and that she obsessed over this.
And apparently, from a quick Google, somebody actually added this comet to Wiki, possibly. My personal conspiracy theory is the filmmakers, and the page has since been deleted by Wiki moderators and purged from all records. So good on them for trying, but I'm with Jacob. I think that the information being given here is really a bit confusing. Like, the fact that her boyfriend wants her to go to Vietnam for 4 months, and she's like, I don't know if I want to. I don't know what's keeping her there. I know she doesn't have a dance career. I don't know what she does have in the way of a job to keep her in Silicon Valley, which is where I'm taking it this is with all of the references they make, and that one person is in like a Silicon Valley outreach program.
I mean, I think you can infer pretty quickly that she's unsure about this relationship. It's relatively new, and in fact, his old girlfriend is fresh enough to be popping up on the scene dating someone else. So I take it to mean she is a character that doesn't make a decision easily. And again, she's really frustrated that that cost her something in the past. And now, will she let this guy go? We don't get the sense that they're extremely passionate when they see each other. You know, they start on the phone and, you know, he eventually shows up at the party. It's not intensely romantic. It's not the love of her life. But she probably knows that if she lets him go, this is the end of the relationship. So I take it to mean she's got to figure out whether this is important to her or not.
I know that's not important to me. What's important to me is when other screens on phones start cracking, power's going out, there's no internet service. I do get into like this mystery of the comet. I just think characterization, it's so muddled. And eventually I'll realize you're only supposed to be invested in M. No one really else has an arc here. But I just never cared about her.
I think everyone has characterization. I think you're going to see someone that's struggling with their alcohol addiction. I think you're going to see somebody find out that his friend had an affair with his wife. There are storylines, but none is more important than Emily.
None are resolved other than Emily's, and even that is left a little bit hanging. I would say Mike, Nicholas Brendan, comes in second. And in the end, it's going to be Emily and Mike conferring with each other. Mike, we're going to find out, a former alcoholic, much like Nicholas Brendan himself, who's worried about drinking, and he goes on to drink. We're going to find out he is the one who had an affair. I do think they could have cut two people out of this story, though. I think that would have made it clearer to have six friends together. I'm not sure that everyone has a complete purpose, other than if it was six people, it would be really weird that Lori showed up uninvited because she was dating Amir.
I agree with you. It's six friends, and that's the core group here, and then there's the interloper. It is this Lori, and she's the one that could potentially really cause a lot of problems here. All these people got together last Thanksgiving. They haven't seen her since Kevin was dating her. And Kevin doesn't want to see her. Or does he? I mean, again, a source of tension for our main character in this relationship. How much do you know about Nicholas Brendan? I did know that he was making a joke by saying, I was on a TV show called Roswell, and I knew that, in fact, it was Buffy.
I know virtually everything about Nicholas Brendan. I mean, I watched Buffy starting its first season, which is really his claim to fame. I mean, we did discuss him before that. He was in Children of the Corn 3, let's remember.
Nope.
And then I most recently saw him on an episode of Dr. Phil. I've never watched...
That's not good.
I've never watched Dr. Phil before or since.
Do you gotta cash him outside?
Apparently, I missed the episode where Nicholas Brendan came on to discuss his alcohol problem. See, I go to a lot of these conventions. Nicholas Brendan was arrested at several conventions for assault or tearing up his hotel room or various disorderly conduct. In mid-2015, he went on Dr. Phil. He didn't like how Dr. Phil was treating him, so he walked off, and Dr. Phil and Nicholas Brendan's mother continued the episode talking about Nicholas, and then Nicholas came back himself in December of 15, where he's like, I'm ready to get help, and it ends with Dr. Phil sending him to a treatment center. Now, that's 2015. This movie came out in 2013.
Shot at the end of 2011.
I did look it up, and Nicholas Brendan's first being tasered and arrested by the LAPD was in March 2010. So this is at the start of his problems, but he was having alcohol problems. He had already checked himself into a sobriety center once by this point, at least once that's publicly known.
Yeah, I thought that was actually kind of touching. It felt honest. It felt like everyone here is playing a riff on themselves. And so, yeah, quite a thing for a BC Lister TV star to start talking about his alcohol problem, and basically that he had to give up his career and live off of his wife, who had him relocate from LA, probably because the party scene there was too tempting. And so now they've, yeah, this all is taking place somewhere nebulously in San Francisco, Bay Area, Silicon Valley.
Yeah, I'll just peg it as San Jose. You know, that's where so much of that stuff is. And there's a lot of people here who do work in the tech industry. They drop various careers that they do. And yeah, he's a retired actor living with the person they say she owns Skype. So obviously he doesn't need to work. They have a very gorgeous house.
Yeah, but if they had gotten the actor from Roswell, this might be an entirely different character. I think I always liked that when they trust the actor to kind of create the character. I think that's impressive here. And the fact that he's willing to be honest with it when you're telling me he's still in the throes of addiction for several years to come, even more impressive.
I wish I could like it more. I agree with you. I definitely saw that in here when he's talking about drinking. Part of me wondered, is that real wine that they're drinking, or is that grape juice or something on the set? Because that was compelling, knowing his personal drama. I wish I didn't have to have meta-knowledge to like these characters. I don't like any of these characters for what they give me on screen. I can identify them, but they're not even types. They're just, like you say, they're being versions of themselves, but I think they need a stronger through line than here's some dialogue you have to say, whether or not you as you would know it, and try to figure out a way to drop it in.
I went into this without any of that meta knowledge, so maybe that makes it more interesting. It didn't for me. I just wish I could understand these characters. They're just talking over each other. Again, I just need a little bit of a script just to organize this a bit more at the beginning so I could get who everyone was without having to go back and maybe watch it a second or third time. There's enough mysteries here where you'd want to go back to maybe watch it multiple times, but to figure out the characters shouldn't be one of them.
Here's what I would say. As someone that watched a whole lot of indie movies throughout the 90s, this is its own genre. The mumblecore, let's just get some people together, Clerks, what have you. This is a familiar setup. You get people talking. Whit Stillman had a career out of this. You get people that you know in a room. You have them talk. And that is an indie movie. I mean, that was enough for many productions. So to see this setup at a dinner party felt like something I'd seen hundreds of times. The fact that there was something ominous going on with the cell phones and a comet passing by gave this a unique edge. I was like, oh, I'm more intrigued than I normally am at these things.
And that's what's holding my interest, is that intrigue. They keep talking about a door to nowhere because Beth, I guess, is a hippie feng shui expert. You say Clerks. At one time, that dialogue was super funny to me when I was in college. To this, I just don't find anything interesting in the dialogue.
And the thing with Clerks is that is completely written, and there's not people talking all over each other at the time. There is sometimes where people do have foreground conversations, but it's got an audio mix that allows you to hear it. That actually, I guess I saw some ADR credits here, so I guess they did a little bit of ADR for this movie as well. But I'm really not invested in the characters. I'm very invested in what's going to happen with this comet. The phones keep breaking. They're talking about this woman who said she killed her husband. I don't know where it's going to go. And the power goes out. I'm excited. Hey, we're now not just talking. We're now going to have some stuff happen. Truthfully, the first time through, I stopped caring about the characters to the point that I stopped paying attention to the characters. I now wanted to see what happened to the characters. What is going to impact them?
Here's the thing. I'm hearing that you guys are damning this movie for that with the extra knowledge of saying, well, because they're improvising this, that was the problem. I just think maybe you're not a fan of this type of movie. There are hundreds and hundreds of this kind of movie with this kind of improvisational style. They make money. There's a whole genre to it, but maybe it's just not something that interests you.
Hey, there's many Christopher Guest movies I have seen into the ground. I like many situations that are improvisational. We talked about Bad Boys. That movie was a lot of improv.
Oh, yeah, okay. This is my point. You guys are familiar with a more polished production than even what they're going for. The fact that it's a movie about people talking in a room is probably something that I'm guessing you'd never see.
I'll just say this. I have seen movies like this, and I always do feel a little bit let down. I go in with high expectations where, yeah, we're just going to riff and see where it goes and improvise. And I always feel like, that never quite works out as much as I want it to. And this is just another example of that.
I'll agree. I've seen movies like this, and I've seen scripted movies of people in a room. And I find this one to be problematic with the characters and the way they convey information. Some huge pieces of information are kind of glossed over because of how they come up. It has a real naturalistic feel, but I never feel like I'm in a room with my friends.
Well, 20 minutes and we're in Act 2. We know that there's a blackout. We know that there's this mystery house two blocks away. It has all the power. Why would that be? Again, that was the selling line that they gave Paramount Studios. Power outage. One house has light. It's a mystery. I'm intrigued with that. That's enough for me. I'm curious as we see these expositions to go to the mystery house.
I'm right there with you, Stuart. That once we get into this mystery, and again, you don't have to take a long time to get there, which I appreciate because I don't care about these characters that much. So the faster we get into this mystery, the better. I love it that, yeah, there's this mysterious house. Is it someone that's off the grid? That's always ends up being like an axe murder or something. Like, I don't know where this is going, and that feels exciting.
Yeah, this is probably my favorite 10 minutes of the movie. The lights are out. People are trying to figure out how to react. Amir and Hugh decide they're going to go. They pull out the glow sticks. I did find it an odd bit of exposition. I have 3 colored glow sticks. I don't know exactly what Mike does for fun in his spare time. I'm guessing rave.
He raves a lot. Yeah.
Actually, yeah. If he's an ex-alcoholic, yeah. That's exactly what I would presume.
I mean, he's got like factory sealed boxes of glow sticks. Speaking of clunky exposition, you get Hugh, who numerous times, because there's no script, is like, I'm supposed to talk to my brother. He's a physicist. Did you know my brother's a physicist? And he told me. They keep bringing that up. I'm like, I get it. Your brother's a physicist.
The other bit of clunky dialogue is they bring up Schrodinger's cat. And that's something that I've discussed many times. I don't know that that's what this is. What they're dealing with is multiple realities, parallel universes. Schrodinger's cat is merely that things exist and don't exist simultaneously. I don't know that's the greatest way to describe an infinite variation universe theory. I don't know that we ever get to the box that's alive and dead.
Well, I don't think that's the point. I think this is a refutation of Schrodinger's cat, because that's all about the observer effect. You don't know it's both alive and dead until there's an observer. This, they do say the coherence theory, like, and they throw out decoherence at 1.2 just to make it confusing. But I do think they're saying, no, there are two realities where both of those cats, it's not just until the observer sees it, it's the cat is alive in one reality and dead in one reality, except there's not just two realities. We're going to see multiples eventually.
To me, it was always a concept I struggled to understand. This movie actually did a really good job, I thought, of finally explaining it. It's a big part of the Coen Brothers movie, A Serious Man, as well, and I did not understand anything about that movie. But yeah, here I get it. The idea that until someone makes an action, and again, I think about him, someone that doesn't want to make an action. Till an action is made, there are two realities. It's every time they try to get a handle on it that they're splintering their reality into more and more fragments.
And this is all foreshadowed by that story that M tells about the woman who kills her husband. I figured that out when Amir and Hugh, they go out to that house and eventually return. He's been hit on the head, he's bleeding, and they've got this box with pictures of themselves in there. Like, again, this is intriguing, I'm digging this.
I'm liking it as well. What is the box? Are they even lying? Because they're like, we don't know what this box is, then why did you grab the box? And while they were gone, there was some banging at this door to nowhere, as they call it. There's a door near the dining room table. They say it's the door to nowhere, somebody's banging on it, and when he comes back, he's talking about how when he got to that other house, nobody answered at the front door. He walked around, he banged on the side door. They accuse him of walking in a circle, but then where did he get the head wound? Where did he get the box? I am very intrigued by this. It doesn't take them long to open the box. I honestly thought what's in the box would be the movie.
Yeah, no, I think this movie definitely keeps things interesting. They always are developing things because they know that people will get bored if the concept stays where it's at. So they're always adding a new layer to the confusion. And again, challenging the idea that just as something is about to cohere, maybe now I'm not getting a handle on it because it's going off in this direction. Yes, that they come back with a box full of photographs of themselves, one of which, Amir's photograph, he's wearing a shirt that he didn't own until today. We know he came late to the party. The picture is of him in that outfit in that house. There's no way that could have been taken. So is he playing a game with them? Is he lying? I mean, I think one thing, just to step out of this, we're going to, I think, go down a path of science fiction, quantum physics. We're going to go along with the theory that's provided us. But it should be said, this is a simple existential crisis. It's characters thrust into a situation they don't understand, and they create their own reality. There is nothing to confirm that there are multiple alternative realities, for sure. They could all be tripping on best drugs.
I suppose, but in multiple occasions, we see the same person twice in the same place. And so I think that this movie is not trying to play with this in a Total Recall kind of way. Is it all in M's head? Unless she's had a complete break from reality. I do think that this is being very straightforward in what it is. What we're observing is what is occurring.
I have an incredibly different opinion of this then. We absolutely know nothing about these people or their situation. We will gravitate to the solutions that make sense to us and thus form the movie in our head that it's supposed to be. But this movie tells us nothing about what's happened to them. Again, we're given many different ideas about what could happen. They got gotten lost in the dark. Feng Shui, it's a weird door. He got turned around. He knocked on it, didn't realize he had doubled back and gone to the house. It could be this comet that, yeah, in the 1930s, had some kind of power over people and made them get confused about where they were. It could be that Beth slipped them all something and they're tripping and they don't know what's going on and that they're seeing double as this movie going into their point of view.
I just think as we go on, there's going to be so much different stuff going on. Like the numbers are going to get changed around, what they put in the box. That's one hell of a shared hallucination from the same drug that they're all having, which I don't think that actually happened. So yeah, there's different readings. I think I'm going to go with the simplest one, that it's, well, the simplest one is still kind of weird, that it's a comet that's doing weird multiverse stuff around this neighborhood.
Yeah, it seems to be the only thing that would make sense. And yeah, they do accuse Beth, did you slip something in our drink? But we're going to later find out this Hugh and Amir that return have the red glow sticks, and the red glow stick box was never opened. We saw them leave with blue glow sticks.
I love that they pull those red glow sticks out, and they're like, it's such a... I don't know, just a cartoon villain thing. It's like, ah, we actually have the red.
And the fact that it was red, I thought they were evil. I'm like, oh my god, the evil people have the red. But yeah, when they kind of showed it to each other, I like that they're together, like, what are we going to do? But the fact that they had to show us the red glow stick.
No, they're not showing us, they're showing each other. They want to make sure that they're the other's partner.
I got that. It's just the way they go about it is so cartoonish, because the way it's presented, this is your first time really getting confirmation. If you suspected that there might be doppelgangers going on, this is the first time it's really confirmed visually for you. But it's just so cartoonish the way they do it. It's not very subtle.
You guys are being real hard. This movie's smart and clever. You guys are giving it no breaks here.
Yeah, sure, it's clever. I figured it out from M's story, though. Okay, there's going to be multiple of all of these people going on and running around. I didn't realize that you're going to have a probably infinite amount, but I figured it pretty early on because of the stories they told, because it stuck out so much.
You're a step ahead of me, Jacob. I was going with the ride, but I didn't figure out what was going on. When they pulled out the red glow sticks, I'm very confused. I realized, okay, they're imposters, but I didn't get that they would be as confused because they steal this box that does have all the photos, all the numbers. I thought it might be a murder mystery. When they were looking at the numbers, I'm like, is this the order in which they'll die? But then there's no number three. Some numbers are repeated. I start going into numerology theories.
I was going there too. I'm like, these numbers got to mean something. Why is there no number three?
I like the way it draws out the mystery to a point. I did find myself intrigued. What the hell is going on?
I feel like you guys maybe are saying it didn't pay out for me in the end, that you're bringing your feelings about, is this worth it when we know everything that this movie's going to tell us? But in this first 45 minutes, I feel like it's really strong and really compelling mystery.
I am right there with you. I am totally into this.
And compelling isn't a word I would use. I was intrigued, but I found my interest waning because of the way information was being delivered. When they pull out the red glow sticks and take the box, my first time through, I noticed that my notes got less and less, and around the 50-minute mark in this film, I wrote nothing down, and I was just forcing myself to care anymore. And it's because of just the pure staging or lack thereof of everything. Whether or not I knew this had a script, if I didn't know that, I'd come in here and say, I hate the way this was written because everybody's talking all over everything. There's no emphasis given to important plot points. It's too easy to gloss over. And the camera work is shaky and all over the place.
Yeah, again, it's an indie movie.
I'm good with the style. It's the way some of these things are resolved. Like, they're trying to figure out what's going on. And the way they find out about the whole Schrodinger's cat thing is that, oh, Hugh's physicist brother just happened to leave a book there, and they were going to mail it back, but they haven't mailed it back yet, so let me go out to the car, still in the envelope with the postage stamps on it. It's just goofy stuff like that that slightly bothered me, that took me out of all the compelling mystery stuff.
I will say that the director in the commentary reinforced what I had been feeling. This book tells you nothing. It is not a plant of exposition to help you understand the condition through a happenstance of what's going on. He specifically says there's nothing they learn here that actually tells them anything about their condition. This is what they hope is happening because it allows them to have a coherent interpretation of the evening.
Well, here's my question. At this point, Mike is getting super amped up. He wants to go on the offensive and take these people out. What are the stakes here? Like, why don't they all take some ketamine and just chill out? I don't really understand the character's motivations for wanting to run around and figure out what's going on. I just say, drink some wine, have some turkey, whatever they're eating.
I hear what you're saying, but I think it's a game we should all play right now. If this were us, if we were all in the same room podcasting and we realized after a power outage that there was an alternative space where Arnie, Jacob, and Stuart were also podcasting, I think there would be two different impulses. One impulse would be, if it's caused by a comet, we'll just wait that out, and in the morning, everything hopefully will be fine. We won't open the box. There will remain two different cats, and life can continue. But I think curiosity, speaking of cats, I do think that, come on, if a supernatural phenomenon like this was going on, you wouldn't want to go see. You wouldn't want to go meet yourself from another alternative dimension.
Can I come down the middle here and just say, I would go out to explore. I would want to know what the hell's going on. It's a once in a lifetime or zero in a lifetime opportunity just to see. And other people coming back and saying this, I wouldn't believe. I'd have to see for myself. I would not, however, immediately jump to, well, I have to go kill me before I kill myself. I have to go out there and kill Arnie, because what if Arnie's over there thinking about killing me? That is the jump that is completely beyond anything I could imagine.
The problem with that jump is I just don't know enough about Mike. He's talking about being, you know, on Roswell and that. I don't get the fact that, I don't know, Arnie, you, I might get that you got to destroy that other Arnie because he's competition. He might take your podcasting spot. But Mike, I don't have that characterization, so I don't know why that character is getting so wound up by this.
You're completely misunderstanding me, Jacob. Two of me means twice the editing. We could split the duties.
But I will say this, to me, it's character revealing. It tells you a lot about Mike without having to have a flashback to when he was in his party days and maybe he nearly killed somebody or watched someone OD and didn't get involved or is just a callous individual. Yeah, you're just left to infer who he is and why he has gotten so callous. But the fact that he jumps to that conclusion so quick, again, tells me, wow, yeah, this guy doesn't think like me. This guy's really erratic and he's drinking too much, and that is dangerous. And later, he will have a version of himself bust through the door and try to choke him. In some reality, he's crazy enough to go through it.
Keep in mind, he has not had a drink yet. He does not have a drink until he goes out and they see their doppelganger group holding the other glow sticks.
Do they realize that's them, though? They notice the glow sticks and they're a different color. I don't know if they realize that's their doppelgangers there.
Yes, they do. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's why they go racing back to the house. So when I watched this the second time, my fun was, who's real, who's not? Because initially, Hugh and Amir leave because they want to go up the road. A different Hugh and Amir return. Then that red glow stick Hugh and Amir leave again.
Hiding the evidence.
Yes. And then a different Hugh and Amir return, but we don't know that they're the original Hugh and Amir. The group seems to act like they're the original Hugh and Amir. They have blue glow sticks and they have red glow sticks that they took from the other house. But there's a 1 in 3 chance that the house they left had blue glow sticks. So maybe it's this movie's, maybe it's not. They certainly act for the rest of the movie like they return to their original house, as improbable as that might be.
Yeah, I think that they'd like us to believe for much of this movie that it's just one other house, that there's a blue glow stick house and a red glow stick house. We were introduced to these characters first, so to us, these are the characters we like, and the people that are trying to infiltrate, take over, steal information, knock on the door and leave notes, those are bad characters. Those are people that, yeah, must be killed or something. I'm rooting for blue team, red team is evil.
And that is the surprise for me, is I figured out, okay, there's doppelgangers, that there's going to be green glow sticks eventually, and who knows what other colors, a whole rainbow of colors out there.
I don't think many people would get that on the first watching, that there was 3 different colors of glow sticks available to them, and they opened the blue.
Yeah, I didn't get that first watch. I so much more came clear on a rewatch, so much that they set up, including Emily's early on, I killed my husband's story, came into focus on a second viewing. But they decide that they're going to split up. And M and Kevin and Lori and Mike go out to see this other house themselves. and then they see the Red Glow Stick gang, and then they run back home, but since they left, I'm thinking they're now in a different house. So now the rest of this movie is taking place. We followed them out of the house. We followed them back to the house. So I think we've jumped realities now following those four base characters.
You know, here's the one thing I would say. I don't have a problem with movies that operate on this budget. I went to film school. I've seen and made films like this. And I've certainly patronized and enjoyed going to the movie theaters to see movies on this minimal scale if they're smart enough. But it is a shame that they don't have the money to show the other house in a wide shot. They mention the fact that they passed through a really dark zone where it could be that they actually, the change is happening, that they become somebody else. We're going to find out eventually they're not even the people they thought they were, that it's not a matter of there's an evil doppelganger of me. It's that I can turn into a new identity without even realizing it when I walk through this dark zone. And to be able to see that dark zone, to be able to see that house in a wide shot would have done a lot to establish those rules.
Yeah, they compare it to like a roulette wheel. You go in and where you come out, who knows? I agree. Like there's one time when they first go out, there's a shot of them all looking up at the sky. I'm assuming it's the comet, but we don't know. They're just like, wow, how beautiful. They don't show us though. I guess there's limitations of the budget. They could get us one or two good comet shots.
Yeah, they could replay the same comet shot if they really wanted to. But yeah, they do replay that shot. And it's after they come back from that second time that Mike is thinking, let's kill them, and goes out on his own to leave some blackmail information for himself.
I did not understand that plot. I only watched it once. I didn't get the point of blackmailing himself.
What they're assuming, and it ends up not being true, but what they're assuming is that in all of these other realities, we only think there's one right now, everything was exactly the same until the comet came. And that introduces Schrodinger's cat. Now there's suddenly a box where the cat's alive and the box where the cat is dead. And they're, for the night that the comet's out there, these two possibilities exist. But in both of them, their pasts are the same. The relationships up to that point, those characters have all done the same thing to each other. And so a year ago, this Mike, or actually I think it was a couple years ago, this Mike slept with Beth and thus betrayed his best friend Hugh.
And I didn't even get, even on second viewing, exactly what was going on. I finally, on the second viewing, got the ramifications of his going out to leave this blackmail note, but I'm still not quite sure what he was trying to accomplish with this blackmail.
I get it. What's your question?
What was he trying to accomplish with his blackmail?
Okay. They are thinking that the exact same thing is happening down two blocks away. And so they believe, because they looked through the window and saw that Beth was the one napping, and Beth was the one that knew about the book, that Beth in that world has not told them to go get the book. And thus, if they don't have the book, they don't know about all the parallel realities. Thus, if he can blackmail himself not to go outside, not to get that book, they will never intermingle with the other house. It does make sense. I mean, I just want to stand by this. It is all done in dialogue, and it is maybe character names that sometimes, it was the character names. They're all so bland.
Mm-hmm.
That was the problem. Still, I might call Mike Bob because I get writing his name wrong. But, and again, because we know some of them from TV and what have you, we have names associated with them. But I do think, yes, there was a real good reason to try and keep the other house sequestered. That's what they're hoping to do by saying, if you don't stay put, I'm going to tell Hugh in your reality about what you did. And he knows that will work, because if the same thing were done to him, he wouldn't go outside.
And what I would like to see around this point, you know, they talk about, oh, maybe you're going to be stuck in whatever reality once that comet passes. And so that's why it's so important that we figure out who's who. I guess I would have liked to know what the stakes, like late towards the end of the film, we'll see a few different shots of these multiple realities. And most of them, this dinner party is fighting. There's only seems to be one where they're happy. But I would have loved, so it's like, oh, so you're all fighting and you all cheated on each other. Like, what are the stakes here? Because it all seems pretty miserable. I mean, at one point they even say, what if we are the dark version? And it seems like almost all of them are the dark version.
The last bit of this movie is where both times I found myself completely turned off, because it's where they start doing things that don't make sense. Because, for example, they decide, okay, now that we've realized that we could leave this house and not come back to this house, let's get a box together. Let's do photos. None of them are really giving much lip service to, you mean like that box that we were looking at earlier?
Yeah, that was confusing. Like, they're coming up with the idea that they had already seen that freaked them out, but they're not acknowledging that.
I think some people are acknowledging that, and some people think that it's still going to be unique because the numbers will be different. Because we're rolling dice, there's no way that the dice roll will be the same in the other house as ours. And keep in mind, that was why there was no three on those numbers. It was a random roll of a die.
I get that, and yet theory of parallel universes say, if the same people are doing the same thing at the same time, at what point does divergence take place? Why would Amir's photo be slightly different than the one in the box because they just took it, but yet all the other photos are exactly identical, even though they were taken in other realities?
Yeah, because of the comet. Because everything happening underneath the comet means that all bets are off. It is no longer parallel.
But I never, I guess, thought it was parallel from the very beginning. I always thought that they may have opened doors to parallel universes where things were different. And in fact, that's what we're going to find to be the climax, is that's the case. So therefore, all of the similarities and the lack of differences, I would expect differences to be more along the lines of Back to the Future 2 when Marty McFly returns to 1985 and it's Biffland.
Well, I don't know if they're going to be that drastic. I mean, you get the theory of multiple universes, parallel universes, where they're infinite. They're every reality. So it could, the only difference could be maybe what you had for breakfast today. So again, I wish they would have established this more. It would have helped me understand the stakes that are there to try to get back to your universe, that you really love that place. And so you want to get back there. Here, again, it's a few shots and they all seem pretty similar.
Yeah, that's the thing, is there's infinite. Anything can happen. You could go to a post-apocalyptic wasteland. You could go to Biff World, where Back to the Future is reality. Or you could go to the one where you had a different breakfast. It seems, for all these different universes we're going to view, they're all pretty the same. So the slight differences annoy me, because why weren't there more?
Yeah, it's the conceit you need to give this movie. Yeah, it's not more because they don't have the budget to do elaborate alternative worlds. I mean, leave that for Creepshow 3, I guess, remote control. But I don't think that that's necessarily even what's going on. You're asking what the stakes are. The stakes are Emily. This movie is asking you to invest 100% that Emily needs to make a decision. Again, her whole life hinged on her not taking that dance show that she created and watching the understudy become a major star because of it. Now she's confronted with a relationship in which Kevin could very easily cheat on her. He is now starting to flirt with Lori, and she's got to decide whether she wants to fight for him or not. And so she goes out to her car and gets that ring that he got her for the state fair, and then encounters a different version of him. Was all of this a trick to get her switched? Is the Emily that comes back in even the same? We'll see her pull the same trick at the end, but this is where the movie really does start playing with differences of character.
I got that it was a different Kevin, but not that that's where she got the idea from. I just thought, oh, I've interacted with a doppelganger of my boyfriend. Maybe I could find a better version of him and a happier life if I play the roulette wheel and go into that dark space.
And I, on two viewings, didn't get that that was doppelganger Kevin. I didn't know that that wasn't the Kevin from the house.
It's the way they look at each other.
He didn't know the ring.
No, he talks about it, what a great day they had with that ring. He's like,
Arnie, he's bullshitting. And then, like, she asked him follow-up questions, and he clearly looks at her like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Most people don't know what anybody else is talking about in this improv of land.
No, I think that this movie plays on that. I mean, I definitely feel like where you're going to see the differences are the subtleties of the way people are responding. And again, you're now reading faces, knowing that there are some people here that are pretending to be from the same house, but in fact aren't. They're spies from other houses, collecting information. Maybe they're going to kill. I mean, we do see that attack from alternate Mike. And that was all of these things. There is no blue screen. Nicholas Brendon does have a twin brother.
Yes, I've actually seen him do work on Buffy. It's kind of sad because they both wanted to be actors, and his brother, who has a totally different name, Kelly Donovan, usually ends up doing Nicholas Brendan stunts. And here they did utilize that for the doppelganger.
He wasn't even on Roswell, poor guy.
And he wasn't even credited on this. I did check the credits. I checked stunts. Kelly Donovan is nowhere to be seen.
They didn't want anyone to know. You know, they mentioned it in the commentary track. The director acknowledges it. But yeah, they didn't want to spoil the surprise of how they did things.
You know, we talked about the Blair Witch and how that crew, they were starved, so they would act crazy and different things would be done without their knowledge. Maybe this happened, maybe didn't, but I feel like there could have been some scenes where I'm guessing they were giving cards, hey, this is what your dialogue is going to be tonight at the shoot, and not let the other characters know. So they tell one character, okay, you're going to have this conversation. The other one's just going off a totally different place because they're a doppelganger from another universe. You could have seen that confusion. I just think there's little things where they could have sold this better, but instead you get this moment with Kevin. It was enough, but it's just not satisfying. Like, I want to feel the chaos and not just the incoherence of what's going on.
I agree. Stronger characterization through character development, be it even just having these eight people in the workshop with the director and the co-writer to know what they were doing better and to have stronger identities in their prime reality and then be able to have subtle differences in their alternate realities would have gone a long way. I'm hesitant to blame the actors for not acting well due to the circumstances of the film's creation, but I'm not getting what I need from their performances either.
I'm not having these problems, but more to the point, I just want to stress in my reading of things, I don't know what you guys are concluding is something they need to establish is not something they're trying to establish. It's a theory about what's going on. It is not to be made concrete. What we are to care about is that Emily wants to be happy, and this climax is all about her. She is going to make a decision. She is going to open the box. She is going to say, I don't want this world. If the comet passes and I'm stuck with these people, I am not happy. So I'm going to find a world where Lori doesn't exist.
And I was excited when we got to this conclusion because I took that story she told. I'm like, that's foreshadowing. There was a murder there. Now she's going to go full like stalker and like start killing all these different realities of M so she could find that happy universe. It doesn't quite go that way, but I'm pretty satisfied with what she ends up doing.
I like the fact that I don't like her because she decides to go bloodthirsty. For some reason, as the night's gone on, it's been very convenient. It's been like a Benny Hill sketch. Hugh goes out the door, a different Hugh comes in the door, you know? But it starts with Mike seeing his doppelganger, and then Emily's just going to wander reality to reality and try to get off of a glimpse through a window which one she wants to do, steal the ketamine from one, and use it to attack Emily in another, and killing your own clone type of thing. Here, I view her as pretty evil, because in the end, when it all comes down, I've now come down on the side of Jacob. Outside of curiosity, I would not be, let's go and find a different me, and if I could kill me to make me better. If I found that parallel of reality where Arnie won the lotto, but I'd have to kill that Arnie to assume his life, I don't think I'd do it.
Well, whether you do it or not, it's interesting to contemplate. It's the science fiction of this scenario. I think it's fascinating when you put yourself in her situations and know how much she's regretting what cost her dance career. I think that, yeah, you could see her getting very desperate. She's potentially going to lose Kevin in the reality that she was. He was kissing Lori in the dark. So, yeah, she had to do something. And I think the house that she settles on is the house that never lost power. The generator never went out here. Nothing else is different, but because there was always light, because darkness was never introduced, these characters never got dark. They just talked happily.
See, and I took it a different way. I took it, this is the house where they just didn't go out to find out what was going on. That they stayed in and talked, which is the normal thing to do.
Yeah, because of the generator. Because their generator never went out.
Oh, I figured even if the generator went out, they were cool, they lit some candles, and they talked and smiled through it.
That's how you know the generator didn't get out. There's no candles lit in that house.
Okay, I did not notice that level of detail.
That's why I say this movie is smart. Pay attention to the details. There are very rich readings here.
I didn't get that this was all a cohesive group and that she was trying to be an interloper. But when I said that it's not a choice I would make, my reason for saying that isn't just to discuss myself, but to say Emily's a bad guy now. She's a villain. She's our main character, but she's making an evil choice. And in fact, the actress is playing it that way. She's full of dark looks and skulking and attacking herself from behind. And so it's interested me, whereas I really dropped out of this movie during that, I'd say, second 40 minutes. The climax brings me back to be like, is she going to get away with it? Is she going to get her comeuppance? Because she does not deserve happiness in my mind.
See, and I took it the other way, that not so much that she's a villain. She doesn't kill the other one, which that's what you gotta do. You gotta kill that other one. You can't just knock him out with the toilet seat.
Yeah, what is she thinking that just leaving it in a bathtub is not gonna come back? You gotta kill it. You gotta hide the body.
But the fact that this is a character that finally feels like she's being proactive and that she's making a choice that she, yeah, like you said, Stuart, that she's learned something from the past. She's not going to get screwed over like she did in her dance career, like she did with Kevin, who's making out with Lori in some reality, that she's going to take steps, and they're very brutal steps, but I'm glad that she's taking those actions at this point.
And to give this movie a complete psychoanalytical reading, let's presume that all that happened was that M just took some of that horse tranquilizer at the beginning, and everything we've seen is just her own anxieties about the difficulties she has being proactive going on. Isn't that what you have to do when you modify behavior? Don't you just kill a part of yourself? You have to kill that part of you that holds you back in order to become someone new, in order to go for a new direction. I mean, I think all of this could have been a bad dream.
Did you see Identity? Not a good movie. That's what it sounds like you're describing.
Well, I think the reading is interesting. Without discussing Identity any further, yes, that movie is a gimmick that has one reading. This movie has multiple readings. I'd like to see it having simultaneously, like Schrodinger's cat. I like seeing that both could be true.
Given that there's two Emilies, I'm with Jacob. I don't see there being enough ketamine there. They discuss it. Hugh says there's not enough to cause a mass delusion where we'd all have the same kind of reaction. So I can see what you're getting at, and I actually like some of your readings better than I feel the reading the movie is giving me. But in the end, I'm not all that interested even to go back and give it that much thought.
I mean, she is a paranoid person. Again, she's the one that went and wikied this comet, has overread about the comet, that introduced the idea about what the comet could be doing to them. Again, if you took drugs and you were thinking a comet was warping your mind, you'd go to some pretty dark places. You might start having visions of you murdering the self of you that has a happier life that you didn't get. But what to make of the ending? I mean, I like the way that they tease it. Of course, she's going to wake up. It's day. The comet is gone. And is she busted? I mean, where are we at here? She goes into the kitchen and Lee is fine. Hi, how are you? I'm making breakfast. And the detail I love is Beth is coming out of the shower. You're like, oh my God. But no, the comet must have gone away by the time she woke up and went for a shower, thus taking the alternate reality with her.
I didn't even think that. I thought, what happened to the body? Is Beth in on it? Is she in murder world? I didn't quite know what to read of it. The fact that there's two rings, if you take the final scene as not being a drug-induced thing, says again, there's multiple realities because there's two rings. We don't see Second Emily in the morning. We see that Second Emily's phone is calling Kevin, but we do see two rings.
Yeah, and what does any of that mean? I don't know. By stopping it the way they do, it's a really good note to end it on, because going any further would confirm something. Emily's phone could be butt dialing him. You know what I mean? Like, anything could have been happening in that moment. It wasn't necessarily herself from another reality. But we certainly think that.
Yeah, Kevin gives her that look, though, when he answers. That something's up.
Yeah, I mean, that again, it's a perfect note of ambiguity to end on a movie that wants their stories not to cohere completely.
Well, at this point, we have Schrodinger's recommend. At this point, Jacob and Stuart and I are all both recommending and not recommending this film. But now let's open the box. Do you recommend Coherence, Jacob?
You took my gimmick. I was going to go, yes, no, strong recommend, weak not recommend. Kind of. There's stuff that I really like about this, and there's stuff that I really dislike about it. And so we need to get those multiple realities, mash this movie up, and there's a version I'd really like here. And that's how I feel like about a lot of this kind of small sci-fi, the single room, or all of it. I go in so excited. Yes, here's an indie take and Primer. Like, I was super excited to see that. I don't know what I watched. Like, there's a movie to talk through. There's a 6-hour podcast trying to unravel that one.
Like, I was thinking about that movie a lot. Yes, Primer. If you like this, there are other ones to explore. I'm going to mention one, too.
And I think of, like, Safety Not Guaranteed or Monsters, just these small-budget sci-fi where they're trying to get at deeper human emotions than just space battles. And I always go in excited. Here's an indie film. We're going to get, like, real characterization. And I always kind of feel like, I kind of liked it. And there are examples of, like, the one I love. I super like that one. But this isn't that, like, I just wish there was a little bit more writing and stronger characters here. And I dig the mystery. I'm going to give this a weak recommend. Hopefully you have watched it before you listen to this. Because if you've seen this, I don't know if I'd ever go back and watch this, but you go to the website, you see where the arrows are. Oh, it's green. Okay, maybe I'll watch that. I want it for those people because I think there is a fun mystery here and that's what I was into. There's a lot of flaws for me though, so it's a weak recommend.
Stuart.
Yeah, I almost put this in the book. I had considered it. I thought it was a clever little exercise in paranoia. I thought it had been overlooked. I think there is a big audience, people that like brain teases. I think there are interesting readings of this movie to be had. But it is a small film. I mean, I think you have to be cool with indie movies and the limitations that come with low-budget productions. For me, what's cool about it is that it underlines the difficulties of making big life decisions. And right now, I can really relate to that. I'm at that midlife crisis crossroads where I really got to decide what is it I want to do in life. So I completely related to the main character, her difficulties, and is she going to take responsibility for picking a path and sticking with it, knowing that it may not lead to a happy future? Shaping your destiny can feel like an act of murder, killing off all other possibilities, essentially ending all the other ways you could live your life. I think that's a very powerful thing to think about, particularly for me right now. It's hitting me in that spot. But I think everyone will think it's cool to a certain extent. I think everyone will be with half the movie. And what you make of the end is, well, I hope to hear about it. Why don't you put it in the forums?
And I'm going to open the box to see a red arrow. I look at this and there's things I admire about it. Most importantly, my thinking from this was, if this were a indie film and James Ward Burkitt is trying to say, I have storytelling and movie making ability, I'd like to see what he could do next. I'd like to see where he could take some of these ideas when he had actually a script and professional actors. And I don't even think more budget, but just more prep. And I guess more budget just because budget equals day shooting. Budget equals you don't have to do so much on a given day and call it usable footage. But not budget as in bring in A-list actors that have CGI special effects. Just simply something a little bit more refined, more honed. I like some of the ideas here, but really, the jibber jabber of the improv actors turned me off from this film. I can't recommend it as a viewing experience, despite how I've enjoyed some of the deconstruction we've had here today. I just don't see this as a movie that's worth the time to watch, even for what you get out of it. I'd just like to see where he could take it and go. But this movie came out in 2013. I guess it went nowhere, as it is still his only feature directing credit.
To be fair, he is working in Hollywood in other capacities. He has not written or got funded his next project. He did produce a movie I saw called The Forest, that cool concept, didn't like it at all, about the Japanese suicide forest and a girl that goes looking for her twin sister. Had some superficial similarities, but not a good movie. Not recommend. But I will say this. I did end up picking another film for the book. It's got a similar quality. It's two people dealing with alternative selves in a closed confined situation. I hope you guys like it when that comes out in just a few months. That's the one I can really endorse.
Yeah, I think there's just better movies with this concept that I think should be seen instead. So that's why I've got to give this a red arrow. I'm sorry, Albert. I give you the greenest of arrows for picking this film and for supporting our show. I just can't endorse the film. I had hoped I would. I hoped I'd find a new gem.
Well, maybe you'll feel differently about our next one.
Monster trucks?
It's certainly going to be a lot more polished with a lot more money. I think $135 million went into putting a monster in the hood of a big old truck. And we're going to talk about it next for you patrons. In just a couple weeks, timed with the release of a similar... I'm hoping it's better. I haven't liked a single Transformers movie, so I'm hoping I can get behind monster trucks if I can't get behind this Arthurian legend Autobot crap that's coming out.
So, patrons, all of you, whether you're donating $10, $100, or $500 to pick a movie for us to review, thank you so much for your support. It's what allows us to keep going week after week and pay for IMAX 3D Transformers 5 tickets. I wish this was a video podcast so you could all see Stuart's first lips. And until next time, I'm going to look for another bottle of wine.
You know, I've made some choices that I'm stuck with. I'm stuck here. I'm like the dead cat, right? This whole night we've been worrying. There's some dark version of us out there somewhere. What if we're the dark version?
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our Podbean crowdfunding campaign, and we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast.
Well done.
Thank you. You did it.
Let there be life.
Now Playing relies on support from listeners like you to keep going. So thanks to you all.
Well, hey, listen, thanks for enjoying the show.
And a special thank you to Albert Z. Kovacs for his support of the show and choosing this movie for our review.
If it seems like a good idea to us, it would seem like a good idea to them.
Now that you've heard this review, head to the Now Playing Podcast forums and share your thoughts on this movie. The link to our forums is at nowplayingpodcast.com.
We're the cat. We're both alive and dead. So there are two separate realities, and presumably until the comet passes.
Or the coherence is maintained and those two separate realities will remain separate once the comet passes. Everybody will be fine.
Decoherence keeps us separate.
Right.
Coherence and all audio and music used in this show are the property of their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended.
Please. No, but if it wasn't them, then Mike is right. Then we can't trust the other house.
We can't trust ourselves.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Inganza Media Incorporated.
I'm so sorry if I'm wrong here and I'm saying something incredibly inappropriate.
Now Playing is a Inganza Media production, copyright 2017, all rights reserved, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Inganza Media Incorporated.
A useless door, which this is obviously a useless door. You put a picture of someone you have unresolved issues with, and it just causes all of this weird energy flow. I mean, I don't even like being over here.
With her new boyfriend, Amir, played by co-writer Alex Manoogian. Manoogian?
Manoogian? That's what I said. I don't know.
Co-writer Alex Manoogian. Co-writer Alex Manoogian. Co-writer Alex Manoogian. Co-writer Alex. And the other bit of clunky dialogue that really bugs me, because I use Schroeder's cat as an example many times in my life. For some reason, I'm fascinated with Schroeder's cat.
Schrodinger.
Is it?
Yes.
Schrodinger?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Have
you said Schroeder's cat?
Yeah. I'm like, is that a Peanuts thing?
I think so. That would be Garfield.
The other bit of clunky dialogue is they bring up
Schrodinger's.
Schrodinger's?
Yes.
Schrodinger's, yeah.
They bring up Schrodinger's cat.
This Mike slept with Beth and thus betrayed his best friend Hugh.
I need to run to the restroom.
Sure. So if you have a bathroom necessity.
No, I'm good.
Now is the time. But will it be Arnie when he comes back?